This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today on the program, we're going to take a look at American borders, their makings and their meanings. Our guest is historian and journalist Andrew Linklater. His latest book is The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped a Country and Forged Our National Identity. Linklater examines the concept of frontier in this book. He says while we often think of frontier as a term that describes areas without boundary, there's an older meaning of frontier, that is, frontier as a line delineating an area of sovereignty. Linklater says, since the founding, Americans have strived to establish borders in order to establish democratic government and individual liberty. He says, quote, to establish a frontier was to create an area of separate jurisdiction. He says the distinctions from jurisdiction to jurisdiction gave rise to the bloodiest of civil wars and yet produced, quote, the most sophisticated guarantees of individual freedom and democratic government that human society has yet seen. To a degree, he says, unknown in previous nations, the United States was the product of the formal divisions that the boundary makers marked in the wilderness. Think for a moment now of the number of boundary makers in our history. Three of the presidents represented at Mount Rushmore were surveyors, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. Borders continue to concern us. Think here of our current debates over immigration and how best to defend the country against terrorism. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments for our guest, Andrew Linklater. You can join us with a telephone call. I look forward to hearing from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Andrew Linklater is the author of several books. His previous books include Measuring America, How an Untamed Wilderness Shaped the United States and Fulfilled the Promise of Democracy. Measuring America and the new book, The Fabric of America, are published by Walker and Company. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Andrew Linklater, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much, Celeste, for having me on the show. That was as neat an encapsulation of my book as I've ever heard, and I really understood what I was writing about for the first time.
Oh, it's a wonderful book. There's so much here, it was a challenge for me to try and give our listeners kind of an idea of what you're about here in The Fabric of America.
Well, it's a curious thing that once you start following the history of the frontier, you are, in a way, following the evolution of government itself from its first sort of really quite simple beginnings. After all, to organize a government of 13 separate states is one thing, but to create a government that will, I don't know, which will create this sort of jurisdictional liberty of the individual across 300 million people is just a quantum leap, and it's interesting. If you just follow the frontiers and the borders, you can see that growth of government, and curiously also the growth of liberty.
Hmm. Were the ways in which boundaries were drawn in America different from how boundaries had been made in Europe?
The answer is yes. It was by coincidence, if you like, that both the revolution and the science emerged at the same time. Because really, before the late 18th century, you could not run a straight line across the land, because it depends upon astronomy. And one of the characters who appears very early in my book is Andrew Ellicott, who is a Pennsylvania Quaker and self-taught astronomer, and an astronomer of a very high standard indeed, who is eventually elected to the French Academy of Science for his work as a boundary maker and as an astronomer. And I really, probably the best sort of yardstick one can get of how eminent he was that George Washington commissioned him to run the southern frontier between the United States and the Spanish colonies, and indeed to lay out the District of Columbia and to a certain extent the city of Washington. And Thomas Jefferson, before the Lewis and Clark expedition, selected him to train Meriwether Lewis in navigation. And right at the end of his life, James Madison selected him to help in delineating the frontier with Canada. So it was a pretty good sort of recommendation, really.
Yeah. Why do you think, I would suspect that most of us don't know Andrew Ellicott at all?
Well, I came across him really partly through because I was writing Measuring America, which was about how the continent was divided out and measured out. But he wrote, he was an engaging character, really, because he had the good luck to marry a wife to whom he was devoted and who was devoted to him, called Sally. And he wrote to her a series of the most wonderful letters from the wilderness, because he spent most of his time really traversing the trackless forests and endless sort of wastelands of the United States. It was on the border of the United States. And he wrote back to her an extraordinary collection of love letters. And from from his early 30s through to his late 50s, he always addressed her as "my darling love, you are the love of my life." And he would write wonderful things: "Long are the hours I spent sleepless in my tent, dreaming of my return to your arms and the charms of your conversation." They're quite beautiful. And so I was really attracted to him as much as anything through his letters and his personality.
The wilderness for him was an acquired taste.
Yes. Because he was an astronomer and a clockmaker, and the two things went together. If you were good at building clocks, you were good at building telescopes and compasses and the instruments that you needed for that. But, of course, that was a sort of pastime that you conducted in towns and in cities. And so when he was selected to run the first frontier of Pennsylvania in 1784, he went as a city boy and as a scientist out into the wilderness, and he wrote back to Sally saying, "This is really a wild and rough place, and the frontier town that I was in, they had a shoot up last night, and the gang who's been rustling was put into jail, and I don't want to come back to this terrible place again." But it obviously got under his skin, because year after year he would go out there, and his letters too present a very clear picture of the reality of life on the frontier and in these sort of half settled zones. And he had almost what perfectly represents in a way the connection between government and boundaries, if you like, was an extraordinary encounter he had with Captain William Lynch, who, of course, was the man who, if you like, represented frontier justice with the Lynchmen. And Ellicott said he listened in horror to Lynch describing how, when they suspected that there was a lawbreaker in the district, that he and the Lynchmen would go down and they would seize this character, and they would whip him, and they would whip him until he confessed to his crime. Then they would tie him on a horse and put a noose around his neck and put the other end of the rope around a branch and wait for the horse to move away and, as he put it, administer justice. And Ellicott says, in horror, But it must be so obvious that the people that they were selecting as lawbreakers were picked out of spite, and that they were confessing to crime simply because they are being whipped. And he says, I cannot believe that this sort of behavior goes on in a country with a government and with laws and with justice.
Still having that conversation today.
Well, yes, but I think that what you can absolutely see is there is, in the end, a recourse to law. There is a recourse to liberty, and there is a recourse to justice. And for all that, I mean, one of the people, of course, that I then come up against, if you follow the formal frontier, then you're bound to come into contact with the myth of the frontier, the far more common concept of the frontier, which is put forward by Frederick Jackson Turner.
Oh. Speaking of outlaws, maybe you would tell us about a colorful character that you write about in the book, The Fabric of America. I believe his name is Cressup.
Thomas Cressup. Thomas Cressup, again, really sort of shows why boundaries are necessary. He was operating in colonial America in the early... He came to Maryland, in the early 18th century from England. And he discovered something that was very clear to the Penn family and to the Calvert family who owned Maryland, that the royal charters were so badly drawn up that no one was quite sure where Pennsylvania ended and Maryland began. And Thomas Cressup stumbled upon the brilliant idea, really, of selling the land in the disputed area to people and claiming the money as his own. And he became known as the Maryland Monster, because what he did, he would take, there were a lot of German immigrants coming, and he would take them to the land and he would, to the area, and he would sell them farms. And if people from Pennsylvania came down saying, hey, this is land that we bought from the Penn family, he would say, no, bad luck, you're in the wrong country, the wrong province, the wrong colony. This is Maryland. And if people from Maryland came up, he would say exactly the same, but he would say, we're in Pennsylvania. And he eventually got his comeuppance when some Pennsylvania farmers, or pioneers, because they didn't have the land at that moment, were so enraged by this, they got the sheriff of Lancaster. And he came down with a posse of about 50 farmers, all with their rifles and pistols, and they had a shootout around Cressup's house. And there's an absolutely verbatim account of it, because the sheriff bumped into a very famous character called Charles Mason, of Mason and Dixon fame, and told him exactly what had happened. And he said he'd shouted to Cressup to come out of the house, and Cressup replied with horrid oaths that he would not be taken alive and he would fight the last bullet. And a terrific fusillade of bullets and fire was exchanged, and eventually the house went on fire, and Cressup stumbled out, singed, and was captured. But he had the last word very nicely as he was being marched in chains through the streets of Philadelphia. He turned to his guard and he said, "Why, this is a pretty city. This must be the prettiest city in all of Maryland." And, of course, the truth was that the boundaries, the charters had been so badly drawn back up that technically Philadelphia was in Maryland. And that, of course, is why Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon were commissioned to draw a new boundary, which would put Philadelphia in Pennsylvania and establish once and for all where one colony ended and another began.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, when we think of the Mason-Dixon line, we think of the division between the states during the 19th century. But the line was drawn in the 18th century over a dispute, a property dispute.
Fundamentally, that's what it was. It was, but of course, once the line was in place, then both the It's an interesting, I mean, it's a curiosity, really, that both those two states, Maryland and Pennsylvania, were at the same time property and administrative units. And so when they sold the land, the money for the land went to the Penn family or the Calvert family, but the taxes that were paid by the people who bought the land went to the colonial treasury.
You note in the book, this is very interesting, that the longest clause in the 1777 Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union deals with border disputes.
Well, it was true, and indeed it was. If you read the Federalist Papers, it's a running theme going through them, particularly in Alexander Hamilton's papers, that he says the one thing that is going to tear apart the United States of America is the fact that they will become, is the danger that they will become disunited. And the reason that they may become disunited is over border disputes, and almost every single state did have a dispute with its neighbor. I mean, in Pennsylvania, and the farmers in northern Pennsylvania went to war in 1775, but they didn't go to war with the British. They went to war with the squatters or from Connecticut, who are farming in the land that they thought belonged to Pennsylvania. And there was a real danger that that a civil war would have broken out in the years immediately after independence. And you can see that that argument played heavily with George Washington, because when he agreed to chair the opening sessions of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, he did so really because he said our enemies across the Atlantic are simply waiting for us to fall apart, and we must have a strong central government in order to hold the states together. Otherwise, the British will set us one against the other, and there will be the possibility that the United States will disintegrate. And so it's an old phrase we all know. Good fences make good neighbors. And until the borders were properly established, there was a constant running battle going on.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian and journalist Andrew Linklater. His latest book, The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country and Forged Our National Identity. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, the struggle that we had over boundaries and borders, those struggles are also symbolically there played out in building the nation's capital.
Yes, the building of the nation's capital was really sort of fraught with problems from the start. Of course, it was the result of a compromise that because there was strong pressure to keep it in Philadelphia, or to have it further north in New England, and a deal was done by which the Southern congressmen voted to let the federal treasury take over their debts, and thus give an increase of power, if you like, to the federal government. But in return, the northern delegates agreed to have the nation's capital laid out on the Potomac somewhere to be decided by George Washington. And, of course, he selected this particular place just by the little village of Georgetown, which was already in existence then. And they were to lay out an area 10 miles by 10 miles, a square 10 miles by 10 miles. And Washington selected two people to do it. And the one that most people know about is Pierre L'Enfant, the French... Washington always referred to him as the engineer, but in fact, looking at the records, he came as a volunteer with Lafayette, and he was given a commission so that he wouldn't be executed as a spy in case he were captured by the British. But the French military authorities who issued him with the commission said specifically, he is only an artist, he knows nothing about engineering. But this will do, the commission will serve for the purpose. So he he was adventurous. He was a very attractive young man, an adventurous young man. He parlayed that into a real commission in the United States Army, and he was very gallant. He fought in several battles and was wounded. And when Washington said that he was looking for people to design a capital, L'Enfant put his name forward, and Washington was just enchanted by him, and enchanted by his enthusiasm. And the design that he came up with was based, curiously, on the gardens at Versailles. Very complex, wonderful gardens, which still exist in a way. And there are lots of radiating paths coming out from central rose beds. And you can see that from round circular rose beds. And you can see exactly that design in the city of Washington still. Well, if you're a sort of seagull or a bird flying high, looking down, you could see it. But he was an artist. He drew the design, but he didn't know how to draw it to scale. He didn't know how to lay it out on the ground. And that's where Andrew Ellicott came in to play. And he really translated, made a reality out of the sketches, out of the plans that L'Enfant had drawn up. But L'Enfant was sort of, I don't want to be typify, but he was, as we imagine typical Frenchmen to be, he was extremely excitable and full of enthusiasm and absolutely couldn't stand being contradicted in any way. And he finally really had such a bust up with the commissioners looking after the laying out of the city that he walked away. And it was left to Ellicott to draw up the final plan. So technically, the final plan on which the city of Washington, D.C. is built was the one that was produced by Andrew Ellicott. But it was clearly a partnership between the two of them. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that the last map on which they both collaborated, there are no names for any of the avenues. And the first map that Ellicott produced by himself, there are names. And so the name of Pennsylvania Avenue was certainly one that that Ellicott gave. And Pennsylvania, of course, was his home state.
Hmm. The city was supposed to be ready to be the seat of government by 1800.
Hmm.
But decades later, you have Henry Adams in 1860 telling us what a mess the city was.
Yes, it was curious. It was a huge city. It was, and really, that was George Washington's fault. It was an enormous site, something like 6 square miles, and the biggest city up to that point was Philadelphia, and it had taken about 100 years, if you like, to grow to its size, and even then, it was about half the size of the city that that Washington had in mind. But he was quite certain, because he was he was a surveyor himself, and he was a land speculator, and there was just this buoyant, driving land market in the United States at the time. And he was quite certain that once they had designated it as the future capital of the United States, that every land speculator under the sun would want to come and buy land, and very quickly they would put up the buildings, the private buildings, and the place would develop itself. But what happened was the land market collapsed, and it just sort of, it festered and it withered, and you're quite right. I mean, late into the 19th century, people talked about shooting quail within a few hundred yards of the White House. The wilderness had grown back, if you like, and there were just these rather muddy paths between a few public buildings. That's possibly an exaggeration. Adams was really wrote elegantly and very attractively, but sometimes not entirely accurately. But it was very slow. In fact, it really wasn't until after the Civil War that the Civil War was what established the Washington, D.C. as being the capital, the thriving center of government.
Yeah. Speaking of the Civil War now, the line drawn by secession, it created a frontier as the Confederate States of America declared their sovereignty.
Mm.
And this is very interesting to think about how we have called this war, the name we have given it, or the names, the war between the states or the Civil War, and the Civil War. The difference, you say, not academic.
No, it's absolutely, it's critical. The war is really a war, as I believe, between different interpretations of liberty. And on the one hand, in the South, it was really the liberty to regard other people as property. And in the North, it was really the sense that individual liberty applied had to apply to everybody. And what the reason that the borders are important in this conflict of what constitutes liberty is that they enclose an area of jurisdiction. So if the laws say that everybody, regardless of color, has certain civil rights, then that must be true throughout the area of jurisdiction. And so when Lincoln was elected president, the South absolutely saw that as meaning that their interpretation of liberty could no longer exist within the boundaries of the United States. And the logic of that was that they had to create a separate state, and that was called the CSA, the Confederate States of America. And they drew a new boundary and had a new jurisdiction and a new Supreme Court and everything that goes with that. Now, the consequence of that is very interesting because by the end of the war, it has become a raging question of how do we treat the defeated states? Are they states who rebelled and have now sort of come back, as it were? The rebellion has failed, and they are back as loyal citizens of the United States. They never stopped being citizens of the United States. And that was the line that Lincoln took, and the corollary of that was that he would allow the southern states back in simply if they promised to abolish slavery and if they promised adherence to the Union, that they would obey the laws of the Union, which was very easy for them to do. And that happened very quickly, but Lincoln faced real rebellion within his own party in Washington from people who said it's superficial. Actually, they were a separate country. They made themselves a separate country. We have defeated them, and if they're going to come back within the Union, we will make them pay. We will take out the entire infrastructure of government they have, and we will put in our own. And that, after Lincoln's assassination, that radical reconstruction became the official policy, and it was the, and so Northerners were put in to run the governments of the southern states, and they were really taken over, and to some extent they all had military governors and small military detachments stationed there, but they really were run very much for a brief period as dependent as conquered nations. And so, it's a fascinating thing that if you follow the frontier exactly what it means, you get an interesting new perspective on historical events that you're very familiar with, but you suddenly see it from a different angle, and it turns out entirely different.
And the reverberations today, how have these boundaries of the 18th and 19th century, how do they impact us today?
Well, most obviously, in the present concerns over mass immigration and the sense that the frontier and I think especially with Mexico, has become too porous and needs to be strengthened. Now, I know that this is very contentious territory, and I know that for somebody with my accent to stumble into this area is not really something that a foreigner should go into. But I just would like to talk about really the way, if you follow the history of the frontier, the way it points, what the direction points towards. And it is very interesting that really almost before the United States came into existence, there are terrific sort of really resentments against the arrival of new immigrants. I mean, there's a famous pamphlet that Benjamin Franklin produced in the 1750s complaining about the arrivals of too many Germans, as he put it. And he says, you know, why should Pennsylvania, which was founded by the English, after all, become a colony of aliens, you know, and they're going to Germanify us rather than us Anglifying them, and they're not going to speak our language, and they're going to create their own cultural ghettos. And that sort of that feeling of resentment really runs through, it runs alongside the history of the frontier, if you like, and very understandably, in a sense. I mean, one's always got the feeling that the arrival of new people with different values threatens the existing society. And so when the Irish Catholics began to arrive in the 1840s and 1850s, fleeing from the British and from hunger, it gave rise to the Know-Nothings, which for a time was the biggest political party in the United States, which was specifically designed to stop Catholics coming to the United States. And Lincoln says a wonderful thing of saying, well, you know, this, once the Know-Nothings are in charge, the Declaration of Independence goes out the window, and it's going to read, so all men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics. And if it comes to that, I'd rather go and live in Russia, where they really have despotism unadorned. You know, the Germans are accepted, the Catholics are accepted, and then at the end of the 19th century, there's the great arrival of Italians and Jews and Russians and so on, and they become American. And so my feeling is that I know that there is the difference, if you like, that Mexico is on the border, is on the land border with the United States. And it is perfectly clear that every country needs to have a well-defined frontier, and that you need to know how many people are in the country, because you can't plan its infrastructure otherwise. And yet, when all those things are said, and when you also accept that there are no good choices, only a series of bad choices, the reality is that up to this point in American history, all the immigrants, the children of immigrants, have become the new Americans, and the United States has become infinitely richer and infinitely wealthier in spirit and in economic terms for having them. And that is the way that history is pointing at this moment.
Oh. I wonder if at some point we'll be more like Europe with the European Union in terms of someday an easier time with this question between making passages from one country to another.
I think not. I mean, I don't want to be either pessimistic or optimistic. I think it's a reality of human nature to feel that there are boundaries around you. I mean, you may feel that I'm being obsessive about boundaries, but of course they are psychologically important and socially important, as well as being nationally important. And so in a way it astonishes me that there has not been more written about them, because they run so deep. But people in favor of globalization will say, well, frontiers really aren't important any longer. It's a flat world. There are supply lines that run through a dozen different countries. Mm-hmm. It isn't important. But actually, I mean, if you look at the economics of globalization, supply lines depend upon contracts. You've got to be sure that your supply is going to honor the contract to supply the goods. And contract depend upon laws to enforce them, and laws depend upon areas of jurisdiction in which they have force, and guess what? Areas of jurisdiction have frontiers around them to define them. So you in a way, can't get away from the frontiers. And if one's thinking of the European Union, we have really, I mean, resentments running pretty deep in Europe as well. Against the idea of being tied in more closely, or between the Poles and the Germans, or between the Bulgarians and the Romanians. And in a way, what one comes back to, it is because of the differences that you need to have, it's rather as Washington said, you know, if you don't have some kind of central power, these differences will get out of hand. And the great argument for the European Union is that Europe, which had two world wars in the first half of the 19th century, hasn't had a war since. And it was the great argument, in a way, for having a strong federal government within the United States, that these border battles did not break out into civil war until civil war. So there is always an argument for having a strong frontier and a strong government within that frontier. Mm.
Let's take a call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'd like to open up a couple of other areas of border discussion.
Oh, yeah.
One between Texas and Mexico, which became the U.S. and Mexico border dispute, and another with the various Native American tribes in the absolutely inexorable westward expansion of the creation of new states.
Mm.
And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, those are two enormous questions. I'll try to answer, or at least respond to them as best I can. The annexation of Texas was seen really by Ulysses S. Grant, who had a front row view as a participant in the Mexican War. And he saw them absolutely as being connected, that if the independent republic of Mexico, which had won its independence, of Texas, which had won its independence from Texas, let's start that one again. The independent republic of Texas, which had won its independence from Mexico, and Mexico had said that if the United States attempted to annex it, they would regard that as a declaration of war. They could live with it as an independent republic, but if it was taken over, it would be a declaration of war. And Grant said in his memoirs, it was perfectly clear that they wanted to have a war with Mexico, that Polk's government wanted to have a war with Mexico in order to acquire territory. And so the annexation of Texas led over to a border dispute with Mexico and the outbreak of the Mexican War. The two, I think, are very connected. And again, according to Grant, they were connected with the issue of slavery. It was a desire to extend the area where cotton could be grown. And if you were going to grow cotton, you had to, it could only be grown profitably with slaves. And so if you acquired Texas, and as it happened, the northwest of Texas, of Mexico, north of the Rio Grande, those two were places where you might grow cotton and you could extend the slave states. Now, as to the question of the Native American holding of land, it is inexorable is exactly the right word. In a way, what happened in the United States was not particular to the United States. Across the entire world in the 19th century, it's a great revolution. It's almost the hidden revolution by which communally owned land held by indigenous peoples was seized from those peoples and transformed into private property or state property. And it happened in the United States, it happened in Canada, in Argentina, in South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. It happened on a huge scale in Russia. I mean, Russia has a frontier literature and a frontier history as extensive as the United States. And there, too, the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks lost their land, which they'd held traditionally and communally, to private landowners. So that what you're bound to look at is really an almost sort of a social evolution, and that it took on the form of private property, transformation into private property in the United States, was because that was the jurisdictional shape of the United States at the time. The tragedy of the Native Americans is one that is shared around the globe, and in a sense, we are all aware of it. We all have benefited from it, and so we all bear some responsibility for it. But I have to say, just personally, and this is an absolutely personal feel, that one can't really apologize for the past. One can be aware of it. One can be aware of the terrible damage and destruction and death that is done, and one can take a private oath that one will never allow oneself to be a participant in those sort of things oneself, should they occur in the future. But it seems to me a slightly empty gesture to make a public apology. Now, I know that a lot of people do believe in that, and they are people I respect, but I just feel about it differently.
We only have a minute or two left in this portion of the program. What would you like to leave us with? What would you like to sum up with?
It is really that a frontier is a thing. If there's one good thing to come out of the terrible events of 9/11 and mass immigration, it is that people should focus upon the frontier and what it means to them and what it means to their nation and to the values that it encapsulates.
It's very difficult, I think, for us to think of frontier in that way. We are so used to thinking of it in, you know, the final frontier, you know, space and what lies out there. It's very difficult for us, I think of frontier. It's a very useful way of thinking of borders and boundaries, but it presents a challenge, doesn't it?
Well, it may be too big a question to enter on this point of the program, but I do believe that it is a better way of it's a more accurate way of looking at history and looking at the reality of current events to look at the formal frontier rather than at the myth, and it was a myth that Frederick Jackson Turner presented, of the wide open spaces where there was freedom to do whatever you liked, because the reality was that the frontier people who opened up the Western United States, almost the first thing they did was to ensure that there was some government office, land office, where they could register their spread, they could register the land that they occupied, because that was how they made it into property. How do you know that the property you have is your property? It is because there is a map and a description of it, and it is registered in a land office or a state property office or in some governmental department. And that's how you know you have property, which has a value, which can be mortgaged, bought, sold. It is your capital, and you need a government to do that. And I can promise you that the story of the West is certainly pioneers going out, certainly defending themselves with the rifle, breaking the sod, but the second thing they do after they've done it is to draw a map and register their claim with some government agency.
Yeah. And we didn't really talk about Thomas Jefferson very much at all in this hour, but he's really key in this story too, and that was interesting to read how very early in the Republic he oversaw the development of measures for surveying lands, how lands were to be sold, and how frontier communities were to come into the into uh, into the nation become new states. So that's very interesting as well.
Well, it is fascinating to me. I mean, I stand in awe of Jefferson because he's not only a master with his pen, and not only did he entertain ideas of liberty, which resonate still today, but he had the practical turn of mind to see that it was important for a society that it had a way of measuring out its land. And so, but paradoxically, because he's always thought of as the enemy of big government, of central federal government, he set up the two most powerful federal arms of government that there were in the early United States. One was the United States Public Land Survey, which surveyed all of the United States west of the Ohio River. And you can see the survey lines running north, south, and east, west to this day. So that all land that was bought was federal land and already pre-surveyed. And the other thing he did was to ensure that the new territories were Republican. He insisted that the first governors were appointed by the federal government and that indeed the Constitution had the approval of the federal government. And that gave huge power to the United States government over the new territories that were being opened up in the West.
There we have to leave it. Andrew Linklater, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It was a great pleasure.
Andrew Linklater is the author most recently of The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country and Forged Our National Identity. The publisher, Walker & Company.